I'm super excited that we're working with Fright Rags to do new shirts. So Shockwave shirts are finally here. You've got the original logo that was designed by our good friend Aaron Crawford at Cavity Colors. We're repressing that one. And then a brand new design by Kyle Crawford, which is all of us kind of in an old serial, radio serial sort of advertisement. It's really, really cool, and I'm just so excited. So shout out to Ben at Fright Rags and the entire gang there. They're really great, and we love them. We love working with them. And when this episode airs, you'll be able to pre-order your shirts.
Tonight's episode is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the number one source for horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers all around the world. Diabolik offers one-stop shopping experience for all of your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo Macabre, Blue Underground, 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. Whether you're looking for the definitive version of Suspiria or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust, Diabolik is the owner-operated small business choice you have been craving. Shop online at DiabolikDVD.com.
It's 2020 and Fangoria Magazine is back on shelves, and Fangoria.com is on a mission to bring you even more horror content than ever before. It's a great new decade to be a horror fan. Fangoria.com is your destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango editorial team's favorite links from across the internet. You'll also find deep dives and daily thoughts from the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria Vault. Become a Fangoria Plus member and receive 4 coffee table worthy issues of the magazine, full digital access to Fangoria.com, invitations to special events and screenings, and so much more. Go to Fangoria.com and become a member today. You can use the code SHOCKWAVES for 15% off right now.
This is Shockwaves, episode 183. I am your co-host, Ryan Turek, recording from my den in my house because we are still on lockdown. I am joined by Mr. Elric Kane.
Hey, bunker ready. I'm here.
Yeah. And Dr. Rebecca McKendry.
Hey, guys. I'm still here in my house. I have now not left the house in 2 weeks and 2 days. So
nice.
I am out of eggs. And luckily, Elric was nice enough to leave like some soda fairy. He left diet ginger ale on my doorstep a couple days ago. So that curve. My kind of, you know, stir craziness a little bit, but still a little intense.
All right, well, we're working on some technical issues with Mr. Rob Galuzzo, but while Ernie and him converse about that, we have a special co-host in the house, everybody.
Yeah.
He had the number one horror film in America. He's the writer and director of The Invisible Man, which is now available on iTunes, and full disclosure, is a Blumhouse movie, but we got Lee here.
Hello.
To talk nerdy about horror movies. Hey, Lee.
How you doing, guys? Finally, we're together.
Yes.
Nice.
All together and so far apart. Lee, your movie's on iTunes now, man.
I know. Isn't it weird? The producer, Jason Blum, who a couple of you may know.
We're vaguely familiar with him.
A little familiar. He called me and a couple of weeks back and said, Buddy, I got some big news, buddy, but you got to vault it. You can't tell anybody. And I said, what is it? And he said, they're breaking the theatrical window and they're going to release this film early. And I didn't quite know what to say. I didn't know if that was disappointing or not. Because, of course, you know, when you make a movie, you want to be in movie theaters. But, yeah. Of course, there was a little global pandemic that happened. And yeah. I wasn't quite sure how to react. And he was kind of slapping me around saying, this is great. This is amazing. This is unprecedented. And so I think, you know, the bad news is that in future when the aliens land on the Earth and they're sifting through the huge pile of skeletons through the remains of society, they may find The Invisible Man as like the last movie that was in theaters. You know, they find this. but Jason's view of it was, this is going to be groundbreaking. Like, this is one of the first times a major movie studio has really done this due to this unprecedented coronavirus situation. So you're right. It is on iTunes in this weird non-video. It's not a video release. It's actually like a movie in your house.
A VOD, but even still, those have been my saving grace, like being able to watch The Invisible Man a second time at home. And then even with my kids, I mean, we watched Onward. There was another kids movie that we watched, and they're all excited about the fact that we get trolls in our house this weekend. So those have been so nice to be. It's like a treat. It's like everything sucks, but you know what? I get to watch this in the privacy of my own home right now.
It's also great for Elizabeth Moss's Oscar contention. We're down to two movies in the Oscar race right now, I think.
Well, I can't even talk about that without jinxing it. Oh my God. We are all the BBC guy. My two-year-old twins have just stormed into the room where I'm recording, and they want to grab them. So they might contribute.
Fair.
My son Jonesy would like to inform you guys that he is Batman.
Oh, cool, cool.
Okay, guys, I might take care of this.
Go deal with Batman for a second, and we'll do some business over here.
I am so sorry.
This is real, folks.
Yeah, go for it. All right, well, Lee.
This is our Dogma 69 of podcasting.
I know. Well, that's the beauty. I mean, like, I wouldn't say the beauty, because I think everybody's going a little stir crazy, but working from home, it's like you're getting insight into everybody's lives on a much more personal level when you're on like a Zoom meeting or talking to colleagues and stuff like that. You're kind of like getting a peek behind the curtain and seeing their family lives, and like the curtains are coming down.
I was on an actual like business studio, like writer's room call a couple days ago, and everybody was talking about how long it's been since they shaved their legs, and it's crazy.
That sounds like my kid.
Yeah.
Shaving legs, yes. Not the screaming children part.
It's like, but, father. Who am I kidding now?
I know. Well, while we wait for Rob, you know, we have a good show ahead, because our homework assignment this week was to pick three titles currently streaming out there to recommend to you, the listener. So we all came to the table with three titles. Hopefully we don't overlap too much. Mm-hmm. I know my picks are kind of more underseen gems that need a little bit more love.
That's where I skewed as well.
Elric, what was your approach?
I definitely went under the radar stuff. One that you'll appreciate for sure, Ryan. But also, did you guys watch, while we're killing time in between, did anyone watch Tiger King?
Oh my God, yeah.
Ciara and I sat down to watch it at 6 o'clock on a Friday night, and then we did not leave the couch until 1:30 a.m.
Right. So this is, everyone's binged this thing, right?
Yeah.
I think this has all the trappings of a great movie, obviously. I saw people's like fan casting online straight away.
Yeah. The trappings of a great movie, sure, but isn't that why this documentary exists? Is to, you know, I feel like as a documentary filmmaker, I would be like, well, fuck off. Like, I just told you the story.
Yeah.
I told you the story I wanted to show you.
Yeah, but I think the difference is,
I feel like I entertained.
There's a lot of docs like that, but this one, the characters, every single character upped the ante from the previous character, and it felt bigger than a Coen Brothers film in a lot of ways. So I can see why people, there's some conclusions we still don't know after the series, obviously.
Sure,
but,
sure.
Do you want to maybe tell people what it's about in terms of the
stuff? Yeah. Yeah, in Oklahoma, there is this gentleman who goes by the Tiger King, and basically it's a peek into the world of people who either raise, adopt, rescue, and breed large cats, lions, tigers, and so on.
It's kind of painted against this backdrop of the realization that there are less than 4,000 tigers still roaming the wilds of the world, but yet we have over 10,000 in captivity in the US at any given time.
Hey guys, and, by the way, sorry, I'm back. I just wanted to let you know that.
Oh, hey. Well, Lee, we were just talking about Tiger King. Did you have a chance to check it out?
I did. I missed the last half of the last episode, but to me Tiger King seemed like the ultimate Netflix. It's like they took all the other Netflix documentaries and put them in a blender. Yeah. Like, I felt like it was like there was almost too much in it. It was like, wait a minute, now he's. You know what I mean? Like it was.
No, that was it exactly. Where it was like, how does this cast of characters all exist in the same kind of world? Because you realize that this very much like the horror industry, that this is an industry of people who all know each other and all work together and all know about each other. And then, you know, you assume that Joe Exotic is going to be the craziest cat in the entire thing. And then it goes off to the woman who may or may not have fed her husband to tigers. And then that guy on the East Coast who seems to have a cult of women surrounding tigers. And then that guy from Vegas who wore nothing but affliction comes in and clearly has a ton of schemes going. And don't forget
the guy who, you know, apparently served as the basis for Scarface. Mm-hmm. You know,
the guy
with the monkey. I mean, like it is. And it's really interesting because it's just like, it's a peek into a part of America that people were not aware of or did not even monitor. And I'm watching this whole documentary and I'm thinking about my trip to Shambhala, where Tippi Hedren, you know, she's got exactly this. She's got a wildcat compound just outside of Los Angeles that welcomes, I mean, maybe not now, but I did this about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, where she rescues large cats. And they did a great film about it, you know, called Roar. Right, I don't know if some of you saw Roar.
A startling photo of Tippi Hedren keeping a full-grown lion in her house in the 70s.
Yeah.
And there's a photo of a young Melanie Griffith in bed with the lion. And I was thinking, that might be a step too far.
Yeah.
I know.
Now, we had one in my hometown that actually, when they were showing, they pulled up this map of all the places that Joe Exotic had sold baby tigers to. And all of a sudden, my hometown lit up. We had, and they just closed it down last year for over 122 cases of animal abuse, but it was called Wilson's Petting Farm. And I had a birthday party there when I was a kid. Like, it was a big thing in my town, but it was like a roadside zoo.
That's amazing. Well, I mean, like what? I mean, hats off to this documentary team for basically. I mean, like the thing is we dove into it and we're in like anything that I series. I'm like, okay, I'll give it one or two episodes, but they managed to keep you going at the end. I mean, it was true cliffhanger, serialized storytelling.
There's a thing in screenwriting. That sounds very like highfalutin of me to say that, but you'll. Every now and again, I'll have a film and you'll pitch it to someone and they'll say, there's too much movie in that movie. Like you need to pick a lane. Yeah. It doesn't know what it wants to be. And sometimes with Tiger King, as much as I enjoyed it on a sort of fun, trashy level, it's like there were so many little strands and characters in that movie that could have made their own six-part documentary. Like just that guy committing suicide could have been its own 6-part Netflix documentary.
Oh my God. Yes.
Was that technically a suicide? It looked.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I guess they never really, but I felt like you could make a 6-part series about whether it was or it wasn't.
Becca, are you suggesting that someone popped him?
No, he was putting, it was off screen and he was playing around with the gun. I thought, I didn't think that.
He's playing around like William S. Burroughs was playing around.
Okay. Fair enough. And he had threatened it earlier in the movie, but okay.
Yeah. No, but I agree with you, Lee. I mean, like the funny thing is like, you've got the guy from the East Coast who is, you know, a giant person. I mean, everybody's a giant personality, but the guy with the fedora and the five wives, he worked with some of the best filmmakers in town and best producers. It was funny because like a couple days after I saw some like photo going around of Britney Spears standing next to this guy with one of her lines and everybody's like, how could this be? And it was like, did you all pay attention to the documentary? The guy provided tigers for the industry, for everybody in this biz.
Right.
You know, so wild.
Well, the Scarface guy that you mentioned, I agree with Lee about that. Yeah. That is could be its own series, but he had one of the best lines I've seen in anything all year. He's like, you know, I didn't actually cut that guy's body up, but I was there. He's just like, but I was standing right next to the body being cut up. It's like, loved Jesus Christ.
I loved his story about how he was like, and so I drove to Florida to kill her, but something happened on the way. And then it's just scenes of him at a strip club, or they showed all these like strip club. And he was like, and I don't know what happened, but I woke up a couple days later. And it was like, had he not gotten drunk at the strip club, he would have killed that woman.
Oh, yeah, no, we've all been there.
Every scene had a line that just killed you. Like it was, you couldn't keep track of all the different throwaway lines from people that just blew your mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So good.
Can I just say, a lot of people talking about Tiger King, rightfully so, because it's so fucked up and such a sort of weird Americana story. But for my money, the most compelling, binge-worthy, cannot stop watching until it's finished Netflix documentary that I've seen recently is Don't Fuck With Cats.
God, I had to stop. I was so captivated by the opening of it, and then it got to the animal abuse, and I had to turn it off, and then everybody keeps telling me I need to get back to it because it's going to be something I love, and the guy gets total comeuppance, but I got to get past that, but it is so captivating.
I mean, I just could not, it just kept unfolding in ways that I couldn't predict. I had no idea it was going to go where it went. And then when I dived into the story afterwards, you know, jumped online and started looking into it, mm-hmm. It is incredible. It's really, I go down these internet rabbit holes. Do you guys do this thing where you'll end up sort of Googling a serial killer and then 2 hours later you're watching some bizarre like,
oh, yeah.
I go down these rabbit holes and I feel like that guy's story is just made for those rabbit holes.
Yeah, for sure.
And I'm so glad that Netflix is finding these. By the way, my favorite rabbit hole for you to research tonight, Lee, look up the guy who played the original Peter Pan.
Oh, yeah. One of my favorite movies of all time, The Window, a film noir. He's the little kid in it. And I looked it up one day and it goes, oh, the voice of Peter Pan. And then what happened to him? And my mind was like, oh, my God.
So wait, just to clarify, are you saying the kid who did the voice for the Disney cartoon?
His name's Bobby Driscoll.
Yeah.
Let me just say.
The voice for the animated feature of Disney, that Disney made.
He was a very well-known actor when he was the
child
kid.
Actor, yeah.
I won't take you through the whole path because the whole thing is fucking bonkers, but it ends with a lot of drugs in Andy Warhol's factory.
And an unmarked grave.
And an unmarked grave.
It's crazy. Actually, that would be a great series. No one's made that one. Maybe that should be like a serial type podcast. But
I did...
just writing it down. Yeah. What's the name I should be?
Bobby Driscoll. So I did a docu back when we had Blumhouse.com. I did a whole like 3-part series documenting his life. Another really fascinating one is the guy who played Viggo in Ghostbusters 2. That's another one. It's a fucking rabbit hole of holy shit. And then you did what? He's like the Forrest Gump, but everything bad.
Interesting.
Like all of this crazy shit and you're like, how was he involved in that? And then over here he was doing this. It's just wild stories.
Yeah. Viggo was also in The Mouth of Madness, if you remember. When he was the guy that when Sam Neill pulls up to the church and he's like trying to get his kid back or something. But he's one of the guys that's in the bar and in The Mouth of Madness.
Yeah, he has an insane story too.
All right, well, let's get into what we've been watching this week. Lee, why don't we start with you?
It's really interesting to have this what have you been watching this week discussion in the age of COVID-19 because pretty much all we're doing in the world is hiding out in our homes and watching stuff. And what I've quickly found is that you run out of things really quickly.
Yeah,
like you start to really have to go to the deep cuts. And so for me, one thing I watched recently was the film Vivarium, pronounced with Jesse Eisenberg and Imogen Poots, which strangely, I wouldn't explicitly call it a horror film, but it gave me nightmares. I had nightmares about it. Like, you know, a film has really gotten under your skin when you just your brain won't shut off about it. Yeah. I don't know if any of you guys have seen it, but it's...
I just watched it. We rented it the other day because this hit iTunes last Friday. And Ciara and I were sitting on the couch and I was like, oh, I remember reading the script for this. Let me check this out. And we watched a trailer and I was sitting there thinking, this is a movie about two people in isolation and they can't escape their suburban home. This sounds like a nightmare. And she goes, let's watch it. So I was like, oh, okay, great. So we wound up watching it. And I thought, yeah, man, I mean, like it's got like shades of Lynch and shades of, like, mm-hmm. a little Cronenberg.
It sounds like the Channel Zero, that the No End House, because that had the same thing where it was like this neighborhood you couldn't get out of.
Yeah, it's very yeah. It's almost like imagine the Truman Show as an episode of The Twilight Zone yeah. directed by David Lynch.
Yeah. Wow. Very much so. Because at one point, once Imogen and Jesse realize they can't leave this house, and as it's in the trailer, so I'm not spoiling it, they immediately try to burn it down, and then one morning they wake up and there's a newborn in a box with a note that says, raise this child and then we'll let you out. And so they're forced to like raise this kid who goes through an escalated growth spurt, and then it becomes like a creepy kid movie all of a sudden. So it's like a weird mix of things.
Yeah, and it's one of those movies that leaves the ending and the entire story open to interpretation, which you know are probably difficult to discuss without getting into spoilers. But it's the type of movie that really gets under my skin. Like I couldn't stop thinking about it afterwards. And the idea of that loneliness of being stuck somewhere in this nightmarish Groundhog Day situation where you just wake up in this bland neighborhood, it really stuck with me.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it definitely gets, in this time, and we're not reaching for parallels to what's going on in real life and entertainment. This movie genuinely taps into probably what we're all feeling to some degree.
It really does. In fact, I turned to my wife while we were watching it and said, like, God, there's no better movie or more apt movie to be watching during this isolation period than this. Like it really gets under your skin. I would recommend it to anybody who's a fan of nightmarish movies in the vein of Under the Skin or you know, Donnie Darko or Eraserhead Lynch stuff, you know?
Yeah. Ooh, okay, nice. You sold me now because I wasn't, the poster didn't really grab me, but hearing that kind of description, I'm definitely in.
Yeah.
I'm going to follow this up with a movie that I watched this week, which sounds very similar in some of the plot points, definitely similar in the tone. I watched The Room, which is one of the new Shudder exclusives. This is from 2019.
Oh, yeah. I want to watch that.
It's a French film, but it's English language. So French director, French actors. It is a couple, husband and wife, move into an isolated mansion in upstate New York. And immediately you get the idea that they've been trying to have a child and haven't been able to, that you don't get the full backstory, but that she may have been through some stuff. And they move into this really isolated mansion with the intention of renovating it. And as they begin their renovations, they find this really weird sealed off room where if you go into the room and say, I'd really like to have something, the room will then produce whatever you ask for, anything. You can say, I want $1 million. I want a bottle of scotch, whatever it is. It will immediately appear in that room. But they really quickly discover that whatever it is, it will burn up, like decay rapidly and age rapidly as soon as you take it out of the house. Like the moment it leaves the house, it starts aging rapidly.
Oh, interesting.
But,
interesting.
Oh gosh, they really want a baby. And so, yeah, then it transitions into a creepy kid movie. And it gets really psychosexual by the end of this. It's definitely a giant statement on capitalism and the whole idea of owning stuff and our desire for physical items. But do you still have that same desire if no one else can know that you have these things? Like, right. Is this awesome dress as awesome if no one else can see you in it?
Yeah, Vivarium has a very similar thematic take on the world in terms of I think, parenthood more so than capitalism, mm-hmm. like the idea of raising a human and what is it to be a parent and what yep. does that mean? And you know, what are we really? Are we just here to sort of keep these other things alive and then die? And this whole sort of it's kind of a horror/sci-fi take on a domestic nightmare, you know?
I feel like these two would be a good double feature because this one, obviously, because you could figure it out just by reading the synopsis, that they, the wife asked the house for a baby. And then the husband sees it and it is immediately like, that's not our baby, it's the house's. And is like completely creeped out by it, but she loves it. And yeah, so it's like a big statement on parenting really quickly.
Nice.
Yeah, that sounds like a nice double feature between The mm-hmm. Room and Vivarium.
I've got one with no social context or satire.
Go for it. What do you got? What do you got?
It's a deep cut. I saw somebody talking about it. That's the great thing. Like Lee said at the start, everyone's just at home watching stuff. And so people are throwing around recommendations left, right, and center. So somebody threw around one that I hadn't heard of, and I'm usually pretty on top of my 80s Linda Blair movies, but I had not seen Grotesque by Joe Tornatore from 88. And this thing is repulsive.
Never seen it.
It's like one of those movies that it's not a great movie, but every 20 minutes it has a huge reversal. Something just wild and bonkers happens. So it's endlessly entertaining, but it opens up kind of like an unofficial FX sequel. And I love the FX movie. So it's got basically this guy, Guy Stockwell from Santa Sangre, who plays the knife thrower. He is Orville Kruger, of course, and he's a special effects artist in Hollywood he's basically Rob Bottin or something, and the gorier the better, and he's going home, and Linda Blair's his daughter, and she's coming home from college to visit her dad and mom, who are the cutest, funniest couple, who are just like into practical effects and basically who can be the goopier with knives coming out of their heads. It's really strange. Like, just even the first 20 minutes, any horror fan's gonna get a kick out of. They come home, and then punks, these typical, just the most unrealistic punks you've ever seen, pass by them and decide to break into their house. And I assume they're trying to rob them, but they end up hurting them. And witnessing, this is your first bonkers moment. So you think this is all the movie's going to be, but witnessing all of this in this weird other room through like a bookshelf is this like deformed mutant guy who, you know, is bound to end up being one of the family members or something. And so he starts getting revenge. And then, as if Linda Blair being in this movie wasn't weird enough, then Tab Hunter, the famously closeted actor from a lot of 50s movies, is suddenly their plastic surgeon uncle who enters the story at the weirdest moment. You're like, what is going on? And starts getting revenge on the punks for hurting the family who were there before. And you're like, this is a totally different movie, while this mutant guy is out there basically killing them. And he's an innocent. That's a weird thing. The monster of the movie, the grotesque, is basically the innocent because he's been sheltered, but now he's a monster unleashed like Frankenstein. And I'm just watching this movie going, what?
What's the relation between the grotesque monster and their career in special effects makeup?
Well, I wonder if – I don't think – it's never explained, but by the end you have to assume it has something to do with they didn't find him grotesque. I think it's like an adopted person.
This sounds like kind of a Mad Libs mashup of about three
different – Yeah.
It's a Geraldo Rivera episode gone wrong here, but it's pretty – honestly, it's actually quite fun if this is your jam. But just even see – Linda Blair kind of disappears halfway through. She doesn't die. She just stops being in the movie.
Where is this movie available?
Oh, this one's Amazon for free. And, you know, I would say for horror fans, you know, if you like bonkers, you can get through it. I'd say just watch the first few minutes. You'll get the fun effects sequence and you'll kind of get a feel. But, I mean, I love these ones that this one wasn't even on my radar at all. This title I'd never even heard mentioned. Right. And yet here it is. There's still great weird movies of the 80s that we have yet to all see. And between us, our collective knowledge of this period is pretty good. They yeah. still exist. I love yeah, that about wow. it.
Amazing, amazing. Lee, what else you got in your that it's not part of your recommends? Have you beyond Vivarium, anything else that you watch?
Being watched recently? let me think. What have we been watching recently that would? Well, you know what's funny is you mentioned before about plumbing the depths and being like, okay, I've seen everything else. The other day, I was lying around. And my kids were asleep, and I was so desperate that I ended up watching RoboCop 2.
I love that. I love
RoboCop 2 yeah. so much.
Here's the thing. I'm a huge fan of RoboCop, obviously, like everybody else, but I had not seen RoboCop 2 since I saw it on VHS in its original video release. And I was astounded, like just in the opening credits, I'm like, wait, Frank Miller wrote this? Yeah. And Irvin Kershner directs it. There was a lot of little things that came back to me that I thought were kind of funny and kind of kooky and unique. Like, I love the little kid bad guy that's constantly telling everyone to get fucked.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, you've got Tom Noonan there as the main bad guy. Like, what are you guys' opinions on RoboCop 2? It sounds like you're a big fan.
It is. I mean, like, RoboCop 2 is just as timely now as RoboCop 1 was in terms of, if we're like looking at the kind of like societal context of it all. But it, you know, RoboCop 2 just has this thread of black humor running through it that I think turned off a lot of people when it first came out, and maybe still mm-hmm. turns off people today. But I just fully embrace how madcap and insane it is, you know, between the thread of Nuke and then the kind of like the fall of RoboCop and then the resurrection of RoboCop and then the actual RoboCop 2 like robot is so fucking badass.
And by the way, Ryan, the animation, the stop motion animation when RoboCop 2 is fighting RoboCop is pretty great.
It's great. It is fucking great. I'm a big fan, and Frank Miller has like a little cameo in that movie too.
Oh, really? I miss that. It's obvious to me, in my humble opinion, it's obvious that RoboCop 1 is the better movie. You know, it's a better crafted movie. You've got a stronger director, you know, for that movie at the helm, and it's a bona fide classic. But
yeah,
I think it's one of those sequels that is intriguing in the way that some people find Ghostbusters 2 really intriguing. And kind of-
yeah, for sure. Well, it was when it was, I mean, like that was the thing. It was like RoboCop 2, Gremlins 2, Ghostbusters 2. I mean, those all kind of came out in like a clump. I almost feel like year after year after year. And mm-hmm. they were all of these like sequels to 80s movies that we were all so like that were ingrained in our DNA. So then we were getting sequels that we wanted to own and love. And I remember seeing RoboCop 2. I think my dad was into it. Like, I remember him loving RoboCop, and then RoboCop 2, he was like, okay, that was a little weird. That was weird. Not as good as RoboCop, but very weird. And I was just like, fuck yeah, RoboCop 2.
Well, it's like all the ones you just listed, the first ones are all 80s movies that still have an influence of 70s movies. Yes. And then their sequels are all just 80s movies influenced by 80s movies. So it's even bigger.
Even the Phantasm sequel that, you know, it just felt so totally 80s by and that big. Point.
Yeah, bigger. Yeah.
Well, the funny thing was that all of those sequels you just mentioned were really bizarre. Like, Gremlins 2, we could do an entire podcast just about Gremlins 2. I saw that film in theaters. Shout out to the Waverley Gardens Twin Cinemas in Glen Waverley, Australia, where I grew up. I went and saw it in theaters, and I remember loving it. But now in retrospect, I guess it was so bizarrely different from the first Gremlins. Like, he just went all out. And, like, I wouldn't say RoboCop 2 was that as far removed from RoboCop 1 as Gremlins 1, but it's almost like in that period they just doubled down on the weirdness and were like, well, we can just do what we want now.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, like we mentioned Ghostbusters 2 up at the top, and you know how it goes from like slime becomes the predominant thing, but they really play up the comedy of it even more so, and it just goes completely off the rails. And yeah, but I love Ghostbusters 2 so much.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. It felt like whereas Joe Dante just went more Looney Tunes. You know, Ghostbusters 2 embraced the more family aspect. Like, it wanted to be more family friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, when I was a teenager and I saw that, that's what kind of turned me off about it. Like, I wanted it to go back to like fucking Gozer and weird shit. And I don't know. There's a lot of nostalgia revolving around it. People love it. So I'm not going
to. Maybe I would have to look at the times between them, but I also wonder if there are like sometimes sequels being rushed, the ideas. It might not be rushed right from the moment, but from the moment they were given a green light, they might have been rushed through with ideas because right. They don't always seem that well thought out.
Funny now, having been behind the Iron Curtain of sequels, like I've been involved in some movie franchises you guys may have heard of.
Yeah. Including the best RoboCop sequel of all time. For my money.
Well, that's not a franchise, but in terms of like being involved with the Saw movies and having written Saw 2 and 3, it's funny now having a peek behind the Iron Curtain of sequels and the economy of sequels because like, you know, the way the producers talked to me about the Saw films and how they needed to get it out and hit a date. And I had all these goals, like, you know, integrity. Like, I was like, no, we must do this. And they were never, I would always get this pushback of like, no, that's too weird. You just need to give the Saw fans what they want. And it was like, it's funny to think back to me as a disappointed teenager. I can sort of see how certain sequels happened. Like speaking of RoboCop 2, I think another sort of sequel that didn't quite work but is still intriguing is Predator 2.
I can
sort of see the vacuum that Predator 2 was created in now because clearly what happened is Arnie said no and then John McTiernan said no, but the producers were like, well, we still want to go ahead. So and I can see how it was put together now that I myself have been through that mill of like, oh, it's got to be this. No, it can't be that because we can't do that. So, you know, and you end up having to sort of mangle things into a certain box. I can say this here on this podcast. I guess no one's going to sue me or care. I wrote what I feel was a really good Saw 3, and it involved Kerry Elwes' character coming back. It was basically Monica Potter, who played Kerry Elwes' wife in the right. first Saw. She was trying to live. Her husband had been missing, and suddenly she gets this videotape saying that her husband is still alive, and she ends up having to go through this whole thing to try and find him, and it turns out that he has been keeping Jigsaw alive. I mean, and he was and I was told halfway through writing that film that I had to scrap it and start again because Kerry Elwes was not available. He was in a legal fight with the producers.
Oh, jeez.
And so it's interesting now. I can see how something like Predator 2 comes about. You know, some strange sequels. It's a lot of times it's people not wanting to come back or. Yeah.
And yet, the idea of Predator 2 is still. I'd still want to watch that one. Like set in LA at the hottest day. It's like hell yes, yeah. I want to see urban Predator.
Yeah, I actually kind of enjoy Predator 2.
Oh, well, what was interesting about Predator 2 is I think I'd have to check my facts on this, but I remember Dark Horse Comics launched their Predator comic book around the same time Predator 2 came out or just before, and the Predator the Predator comic book had to do with being set in New York City or LA. It followed Dutch's brother, if I recall. And he's just as much of a badass as Dutch is, but he's a cop. And it's about the Predator in an urban environment. And I remember going, this is amazing. When Predator 2 came out, I was like, that's what they got to do, right? And I was like, oh, no, it's going to be Danny Glover. And I was like, okay, that's cool. But it was interesting to see what I really wanted out of Predator 2 play out in a comic book thing and then what I got cinematically, which I fully accept because I think Predator 2 is a very mean-spirited, very weird, very cool sequel. So
it has moments in it that are great. Like there are moments in Predator 2 where you're like, okay, now we're talking. We're getting a bit inventive.
Well, I was going to say, Lee, we're having sequel conversations and talking about franchises. I think today Instagrams told me it's the Insidious anniversary. Insidious opened today.
Yeah, that's right.
Look at that. And you're talking about a sequel, Lee. I mean, like I adore what you've done with the Insidious movies. Two is a fucking very weird fucking sequel.
It's insane. Like, it's so funny to have this conversation with you guys. as the person who wrote it. But even I admit that that film is totally insane.
It's fucking nuts.
I wish Rob was here, because both me and Rob once, there's an old episode where both of us talk about how much we love, it's one of our favorite sequels because it is like just stepfather bonkers. I love that about it.
As soon as there's like a rat with a bucket on somebody's chest, I'm like, okay, this just went off the rails. But I love that Blumhouse gave you license to kind of do something crazy like that. I'm on a sequel project. I can't say what yet. Hopefully that'll be coming soon. But it's definitely like I am given a checklist of things that I have to fulfill to match the franchise. And it's we can work within it. But yeah, to be able to go completely off the rails like that is absolutely amazing.
I mean, the interesting thing about sequels is that, and I guess this really pertains to horror movies, especially because, you know, so many horror movies we love, they get sort of parlayed into these franchises, and they keep, the producers will keep cranking it out because they can make them cheaply, and you know, the hero of the film is usually the villain, and so but I feel like there's so many economic factors driving a sequel. All of a sudden the purity of the original is being clouded by these other voices, and everybody has an opinion as to what made the original film successful. And so oftentimes, if the internet is brutal with a sequel and says, oh, this isn't good, or it doesn't measure up to the original, you know, of course, that's their right. A movie should just be judged on its own merits. But behind the Iron Curtain, as a screenwriter of some sequels, there's so many forces pushing and pulling at you, telling you what you need to be doing, or what it's a strange environment to be in. So I really tip my hat to the few sequels that are equal to or even surpass the original. I mean, I'm sure we could probably reel off in 5 seconds all the sequels that surpass the original. you know, like obviously, what I call Mad Max 2, what you guys call The Road Warrior, is to me one of the best sequels of all time.
Yeah.
You know, everybody knows The Godfather 2, but it's a small club.
Poltergeist 3, Fright Night 2.
Oh, my God, Elric, stop right there.
You believe that Fright Night 2 is better than Fright Night 1?
No, but I think they're on even footing.
Elric, you're outnumbered. You're outnumbered. Yes. I finally brought someone else on who backs me up.
I've been controversial in saying that I find Exorcist 3 scarier than the first Exorcist.
It's not scarier, but it's a good movie.
Yeah.
It scared me more, but I was not raised in any type of Catholic environment.
A sequel doesn't need to be better. It just needs to be in the ballpark of, you know, if you get even close to that target, you're doing great work, I think.
Right, yeah. Right.
Well, I was going to say, we went off on a good sequel tangent. I think we should get into some of our streaming picks. What do you
guys have? I have two more things that I watched this week that I at least wanted to mention, because one of them's really good. And the other one I'm seeing a lot of people watch. So I actually want to know if I'm like way off base with it. I'll start with the one that's kind of meh. So I watched The Silence on Netflix. Yeah. And this one, a lot of people had texted me and messaged me on Twitter saying like, this will totally be your jam. Because it is a monster flick. It opens with a group of cavers who punch through this weird cave wall. And then these giant bat creatures come out and start eating people. And this has Kiernan Shipka and Stanley Tucci in it. And it is basically,
what a weird twosome.
It's a weird movie, and neither of them feel like they need to be in it. And plus, this is directed by John Leonetti, like the most recent thing I'd seen of his was Wish Upon, which we talked about on the show. Was not my favorite movie.
Annabelle.
Yeah, he did Annabelle.
The cinematographer of the original Insidious film.
That's right.
Right, and it's beautiful. He is such a good cinematographer. This one, I do have to say, I liked his directing better on this one than I did on Wish Upon, but there is still some weird character stuff going on where like Kiernan Shipka is supposed to be either like a junior or senior in high school, but she's never been kissed and is kind of experiencing her first boyfriend. It's a little unusual. But at the end of the day, it's basically A Quiet Place and Bird Box kind of mixed together. Like when I was looking at reviews online, one of them just said Bat Bird Box, period. And then the other one was like, hey, Quiet Place, can I copy your homework? Sure, but just change it so it looks a little different. And that really is kind of how it feels, where the creatures, even though that they're bats, which is a sticking point with me, the creatures only respond to sound. But Kiernan Shipka's character is deaf and she's taught everybody sign language, so they're able to communicate that way. So it feels like a Quiet Place setup, but it's set in this very kind of suburban environment of her family trying to get off the East Coast because they don't think that the bats are spreading over that far. It's really slow pacing. But then here's the weird thing. Once I started researching it, it seems like it's based off a 2015 novel. They were in pre-production by 2016 and they started shooting in 2017. So it looks like this was actually occurring simultaneous to A Quiet Place. Like these were both happening together, which wouldn't be the first time. We've seen this happen a bajillion times in cinema where two people will kind of have a similar concept simultaneously. And then, you know, they both kind of come out. My biggest complaint with this movie is I love the effects. It had great gore. I will watch bat creatures all day, but there was no stakes. It was literally just the family kind of running. And in that, there was nothing scary. Like people would get attacked, cool gore moments, but there was never any stakes or peril.
I love the idea that someone pitched it as it's A Quiet Place meets Bird Box. One of the things I find really interesting working in LA in the film industry is when someone will pitch something as like it's X meets Y, but the two films will be really similar.
Yep.
Somebody will say to me in a meeting like, it's kind of like LA Confidential meets Chinatown, or it's Deep Impact meets Armageddon. And it's like those are the same movie. The X meets Y thing only makes sense if they're two wildly different movies. It's Ghostbusters meets Salo.
wait, I like that. Can we take that further, Lee? Keep going with that one.
So yeah, I'd seen a lot of people talking about how great this was online, and this one just did not hit for me. I thought it was so slow. Kiernan Shipka and Stanley Tucci were both in two very different movies. And so yeah, this one, though a lot of people seem to be enjoying it, and I highly recommend checking it out just to support it, it did not hit for me. But what has been my obsession this week, aside from the Tiger King, is Pale Horse, which is a new mini series from the BBC that is currently on Amazon Prime.
Agatha Christie.
It's an Amazon Prime exclusive, just got released this week. They're doing it week to week, so only two episodes are out so far. And it's a traditional kind of Agatha Christie murder mystery, but there's witches. It has got this crazy British folk horror vibe going through it. Oh. The whole setup, it's got Rufus Sewell in it. The whole setup is that this woman dies, and when she dies of like this weird disease where all of her hair falls out and she gets these skin lesions and starts kind of going insane. And this weird like little straw trinket was delivered to her door a couple days prior. And then like her whole body starts degrading. And when she dies, in her shoe, there is a list of 10 names. And once the police start kind of trying to research who these 10 people are, they realize that they have all died or are in the process of dying in similar ways. And they all kind of link back to this one really, really weird, fucked up, pagan-y town right outside of, I guess it's London. It's right outside of like a prominent British town. And so one guy is left. And at first he's like, I don't believe in witchcraft. There's nothing going on. And then he drives to this town to try to figure out why he could be targeted. What are they doing to him? And all of a sudden, this like crazy folk horror story unfolds where this like Wicker Man-ish festival is going on and they're sacrificing people, but not real people. They have these kind of like artifices of people set up and they're cutting their heads off and crowning kings. And it's just weird shit. And that's only in episode two. So I'm really excited to see where it's going because it is this kind of traditional murder mystery where you're being led to believe that it could be these witches that are kind of doing this and that there is this cult element. But it is ultimately this guy knows he is about to be murdered and he's trying to figure out why this is happening and who killed these other 10 people. And so it does have this beautiful folk horror vibe. So I highly recommend digging into it. The first two episodes have been great.
What was that called again, Becca?
The Pale Horse, and it's on Amazon Prime right now.
There you go.
And that's a limited series, not a movie, obviously.
No, it's a limited. I think they're only doing like an 8 to 10 episode run.
I've got one more Turk favorite to slip in here. because it's timely. We can't not talk about it today because today is April Fool's Day.
I do love me some April Fool's Day.
Dude, I had not seen it in 20 years. And I did not even remember the last 20 minutes. Like, I was halfway through the film going, I can't remember where this film lands. Obviously, I'm not going to talk about it here because if you're going to break this movie out and you haven't seen it, the whole film is a giant spoiler for the most part.
Aside from Halloween, Ryan, is April Fool's Day your favorite slasher film?
No. Elric just knows that I do enjoy a good 80s slasher film.
I think you mentioned this one not long ago. Black Christmas.
And I watched April Fool's Day probably 2 months ago. I talked about it on the show. I rewatched it when The Blue came out.
So what's your favorite 80s slasher film, Ryan, just to compare it to something?
Slaughter High.
if it's not Friday the 13th. And I mean, I probably... If it's not one of the big ones, probably My Bloody Valentine.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So sorry to diverge there. So what did we think of, what was your opinion of April?
I had a really good time watching it, but if I started talking about what I really thought about it in terms of being a horror film, it's literally definitely connected to the spoiler aspect, which is kind of strange, unusual for a movie, right. But the entire value of this experience depends on not knowing really where it lands. But that made it really refreshing. So I'd recommend people just break this one out. I think I was watching it on some streaming service, which is probably the Blu-ray rip. So it looks great. But it also has Deborah Foreman from Valley Girl and Amy Steele from Friday 2, which I'd forgotten. And so, like, you know, really fun cast. But it's a really fun film. And the horror of it, you know, you kind of have to just got to watch it. It's weird to not be able to talk about a movie, really. But I did have a good time, and I didn't remember it, so that was quite cool, quite a fun experience.
All right, I've got nothing else to add other than I was able to I'll just plug this really quickly because I will go in depth when this film finds a home and is released. But I watched a film called PG Psycho Goreman.
Whoa.
Which is a South by Southwest film that unfortunately did not get its premiere, but it was directed by Stephen Kostansky, who directed The Void, and I believe he was on one of the newest Leprechaun. Could be completely wrong, but anyways, Leprechaun Returns. That's the one I was looking for, the entry. But Psycho Goreman is basically a Saturday morning cartoon come to life about the universe's most insane, lethal alien that is bound to a gem that is unearthed by a little girl living in suburbia. And when she unearths this gem, she sets him free, but she has complete control of him. And what it becomes is a manic, crazy, heartfelt mix of fucked up Power Rangers meets the Guyver, all practical effects, all practical monster suits. And it's just a intergalactic a delight. It is so fucking good. It's super gory. What's that?
Psycho Goreman.
Psycho Goreman, or PG for short. But anyways, write it down, put it on a post-it note, put it next to your monitor, and anytime you hear of news about PG, just know that Ryan was there to send you towards it because it is so fucking fun.
I'm super excited that we're working with Fright Rags to do new shirts. So Shockwave shirts are finally here. You've got the original logo that was designed by our good friend Aaron Crawford at Cavity Colors. We're repressing that one. And then a brand new design by Kyle Crawford, which is all of us kind of in an old serial, radio serial sort of advertisement. It's really, really cool, and I'm just so excited. So shout out to Ben at Fright Rags and the entire gang there. They're really great, and we love them. We love working with them. And when this episode airs, you'll be able to pre-order your shirts.
Tonight's episode is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the number one source for horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers all around the world. Diabolik offers one-stop shopping experience for all of your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo Macabre,
Blue Underground 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. Whether you're looking for the definitive version of Suspiria or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust, Diabolik is the owner-operated small business choice you have been craving. Shop online at DiabolikDVD.com.
It's 2020 and Fangoria Magazine is back on shelves, and Fangoria.com is on a mission to bring you even more horror content than ever before. It's a great new decade to be a horror fan. Fangoria.com is your destination for all the horror news of the day, featuring a constant curation of the Fango editorial team's favorite links from across the internet. You'll also find deep dives and daily thoughts from the biggest names in horror, as well as exclusive access to the Fangoria Vault. Become a Fangoria Plus member and receive 4 coffee table worthy issues of the magazine, full digital access to Fangoria.com, invitations to special events and screenings, and so much more. Go to Fangoria.com and become a member today. You can use the code SHOCKWAVES for 15% off right now.
Hey guys, so something else that I watched this week leads me into one of our brand new segments, and that is our Night Flight Pick of the Week, guys. So each week we are going to be picking a title that is streaming on the Night Flight app streaming channel, which is currently available through Roku, Apple TV, Amazon Fire, and online. This channel is the only place to watch episodes of iconic 80s cult series from Night Flight, as well as an eccentric collection of cult films, music documentaries, midnight movies, concerts, and a ton more. So guys, what movie did we pick as our Night Flight pick of the week this week?
We picked Michel Soavi's Stage Fright, didn't we?
Yes. And Ryan, I know you are just as big a fan of this one as I am.
It will be my next tattoo probably, but it was actually one I was going to present at the Alamo Drafthouse here in LA.
Yeah,
we had a nice 2K print, but you know what? I'll settle for watching it on Night Flight, which has a great array of things, but Stage Fright is definitely one of my we talk a lot about my favorite 80s slashers this episode, but it is definitely one of the most unique and probably one of the best shut-in or group isolation movies, because it's basically about a theater troupe who are locked in by their director over the course of an evening because he wants to get his play right. And a escaped maniac has invaded their personal their little stage space and has donned an owl mask and will chop and drill and stab his way through the theater troupe. It's such a fun, stylish, moody slasher that's just got a lot of character. I love it.
It's everything that you love about giallo films, including just these incredibly lush visuals, but all with this 80s sensibility.
Except for the part where it's not a giallo film.
We've argued this before, Elric.
It's a giallo, though.
I consider it to be the tail end of the giallo cycle, that this is like what they evolved into. It still has the same amazing kind of visuals and scope and setup and batshit craziness. I don't consider it to be a true giallo at heart, but it is definitely part of the subgenre for me.
If you ever want to hear us argue this, we were on a screen draft where we drafted giallos, and this is the only one I blocked, and I felt bad blocking it because I love the movie. This is one of my – I agree with you guys. This movie kicks all sorts of ass. I start super early whenever it first popped up. I remember being blown away. But I think you're right. I mean, but all of giallo kind of morphed into slashers. And because this is an Italian one, it has a little bit of that. But it definitely has the American hallmarks of, you know, like you said, escaped convicts. It's POV shots. It's never about the identity of the killer like giallo is. It's you know, it's about a trapped group of actors, so there's that kind of part to the slasher. But no, it has great energy. It's Michel Soavi, who we all love from Cemetery Man and was one of Argento's main assistants and kind of proteges for a long period of time. And so just this is a gangbusters energy film.
Yeah, when I teach both suspense and murder set pieces, this has one of the segments that I will always use where the girl is walking underneath the stage as the feathers are falling down. It is just so visually amazing, but at the same time, just frightening. And the tension is just through the roof. So just absolutely amazing kill sequences. Yeah. And someday when I find myself with excessive amounts of time, I am going to write whatever stage production they are performing that has a city street and a giant guy dressed as an owl and whatever that batshitness is, I want to see that done full out.
Yeah. if we ever get out of this isolation, I want to find a costumer or somebody to make that owl mask for me so I can go as that for Halloween.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That's a great one. I haven't seen that
Halloween.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Really cool.
So this is that's streaming right now on Night Flight.
Night Flight streaming channel. It's absolutely phenomenal. They get all of the amazing titles from Arrow, Blue Underground, Severin, Something Weird. Plus they have some amazing weird odysseys and hidden gems that you probably aren't expecting. So subscriptions are $4.99 a month. It's $39.99 for a year. And for a limited time, Shockwave listeners can get save $10 on an annual membership with the promo code Shockwaves, one word. So that comes out to less than $2.50 a month. And if you're going to stream, they have some amazing titles. So definitely head to nightflightplus.com and check it out. You can also find it Roku, Apple TV, Amazon, and online.
And then, we just got word that Rob is unfortunately not going to be able to join us due to technical difficulties. So we're going to forge ahead. And in the meantime, between this week's episode and next, we'll hopefully get this ironed out so the whole family is back together again.
Hello, Shockers. It's Rob G here, and I am invading this episode of Shockwaves. Apologies that I couldn't be part of the whole thing. We are kind of going through growing pains in terms of recording the show remotely, and for whatever reason, I keep having issues logging in to chat with the rest of the gang, which bums me out because we're in the middle of a lockdown and pandemic, and I love talking to my hosts. It brightens up my week, and I love communicating with you guys. So there was homework this week. Apparently, we're supposed to pick 3 different streaming titles to recommend to you guys. I did my homework, and there was no way in hell I was going to let it go unread or unheard. So without further ado, here are 3 titles I think you should check out that are streaming right now. First, on Netflix, there's a film called He Never Died from a couple years ago. It stars Henry Rollins, the great Henry Rollins, and he plays a character named Jack who may or may not be a cast-out angel or an immortal that is kind of reclusive and occasionally goes out to feed on human flesh. His whole kind of routine gets disrupted by a gang of thugs that get involved with his estranged daughter. It's just a really weird, dark comedy kind of horror genre hybrid. And Henry Rollins is always good, but this is one of the best things he's ever done. And they've actually made a semi-sequel that he's not in called She Never Died, which was supposed to hit festivals this year, but I'm not really sure what the release plan is now, especially that festivals have been canceled. But that's a really good one. You should check out He Never Died on Netflix. If you head over to Shudder or Amazon Prime, I'm a big werewolf fan. There's a great movie on there called Late Phases, aka Late Phases, Night of the Lone Wolf. And you've probably heard us talk about this quite a bit in the past. It was directed by Adrian Garcia Bogliano, and it was written by Eric Stoltz, who just also penned The Stylist, Jill Gervaisian's new movie. That's coming later this year. We had Eric back on our previous show, Killer POV, I believe it was episode 101, specifically to talk about this film and werewolf movies. It stars Nick D'Amici, who's been in a bunch of New York style horror movies. Ethan Embry, Lance Guest of Halloween 2 and Jaws the Revenge fame. And it's basically a werewolf movie set in kind of a gated old homes community a la Bubba Hotep. So if you put kind of like Silver Bullet into Bubba Hotep, you would get Late Phases, which is an excellent, excellent, excellent movie. And then my third and final pick, if you go over to Amazon Prime, and I would recommend doing this as a double feature, actually, but they've got The Descent 2 on Amazon Prime. They also have the original Descent, which is by far a masterpiece of the last 10, 20 years. But I don't think a lot of people have given The Descent 2 a fair shake. It is not at all the movie that the original is. However, what I do love about it is it's one of the more bonkers sequels out there. It picks up right where the first one lets off. And if you can forgive that the main character from the first one goes back into the cave after everything she's experienced, if you just let go of that initial 20-minute premise and go with it, I think the rest of it is actually kind of a really dark, funny blast. They managed to incorporate characters from the first movie in a very unique way. I think it's a lot more fun than people give it credit for. And it was directed by John Harris, who edited the first film. But I mean, this guy's edited everything. He's gone on to do most recently Yesterday. He did, Trainspotting 2, The Kingsman, Kick-Ass. He's just like one of the top editors out there. And this is his one feature as a director, which I thought he did a pretty kick-ass job, all things considered. So if you're bored and you haven't seen The Descent in a while, I would recommend The Descent and then followed up with The Descent 2. And that would make for a fun double feature evening. So that's it. Those are my three picks. Thank you for keeping me less crazy during this period on Twitter and social media. And thank you for listening. I will hopefully be with the entire gang next week. So talk to you then. Thanks.
Let's get into our streaming picks.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of you are kind of housebound at the moment, probably looking for things to watch. And in addition to finding the things that we just talked about, you can find all of those. We hand selected three titles for you to check out amongst the cornucopia of streaming services that are out there. So, Lee, why don't we go with your first pick?
The first pick I have is a film called Swallow, which came out recently. It's available, I believe, on Amazon and iTunes. It is a very disturbing film. It's horrific. I wouldn't necessarily call it a horror film, but it is highly disturbing.
I would.
You would call it a horror film? Okay. Yeah. It's sort of a kind of cold, very composed, almost Fincher-esque study of this suburban prison that a woman who has recently married a sort of young, good-looking Patrick Bateman-ish corporate type, and they live in this beautifully clean house in somewhere in New York, and she's kind of trapped as this housewife. She's almost like a living doll. You know, she wears these pretty dresses and she cleans all day and cooks for her husband when he comes home. And you start to find out that there's some real inner turmoil going on, and she's really struggling with her place in the world and who exactly she is. Is she just this robot there to serve her husband? And she's basically, without spoiling anything, she develops pica, which is a condition where people eat things that should not be ingested, like nails and staples. And it's a control issue, I guess. It's something that people develop. I don't want to go any further to spoil anything, but it's really, really goes to some dark places, and I can't recommend it enough. It really is so involving. You've got to have the patience. If you're the type of person that needs a kill every 5 seconds, maybe you're not going to go with it. But I really found it involving and haunting and in a way cathartic. I don't know. What did you think, Rebecca?
I loved this movie so much. Ulrich and I saw it at Panic Fest in Kansas City. And this was the most horrific thing that I saw at the festival. And I mean, people kept telling me it's not really a horror film, but it was disturbing. And I remember that when I was pregnant, I remember my doctor kept asking me about it. Apparently, as happens in the movie, it's not uncommon for women to develop it while they're pregnant. And I remember my doctor telling me, like, if you ever have the urge to drink like fabric softener or swallow nails, you let me know. And just being like, wait, that's a thing? Hold on. You're going to need to explain that a bit more. But yeah, they shoot, it starts out so, they make everything look tantalizing, like the ice chips. I remember the first scene where she's eating the ice chips, the sound landscape that they put on those ice chips. I was like, ice sounds really good right now. I just want ice. And then even she's eating the dirt at one point and it just looks so tasty. Like they make it, it's bouncy, like it looks very tactile. But then there's other scenes where she's swallowing like a giant, I don't even know what it was. It was like a telescopic like pen or something. It was very long, like a screwdriver. And then it's shot so beautifully, but you're just watching the most horrific shit you've ever seen.
Yeah, for sure.
It reminded me of if it was like kind of the world of Mad Men or John Cheever's kind of fiction world. We talked about, me and Ryan were kind of trading things about The Swimmer online the other day. It seemed like that world. This feels like it could have been Betty Draper's side story.
Yeah. Oh, God.
You know, when we weren't around her, she was out at home pregnant, swallowing tacks. And because we never did find out why she got so big in that one season, but whatever happened. But it did feel like that. If it had that same composure and these like, I think it's about people when they're too young. Also, she's too young to be married in that role. She's, you know, she looks like she's 20 years old and she's suddenly adopting this kind of not living. I think you summed up with Living Doll. I think that's a great way to put it. Really good movie though.
Yeah, absolutely. I really highly recommend that one.
And almost comedic too. Like it's a weird mix. I decided to go with ones.
Wait, before you go, Becca, but each one, let's make sure we say where it's streaming. I'm sure Swallow is on Amazon, I bet.
Yeah, it's on, I think, Lee, you found it on iTunes and Amazon, Swallow?
Yeah, I watched it through iTunes, but I'm pretty sure it's available on Amazon as well. If you go to the Twitter account for the Swallow movie, they are pretty... really obviously promoting the film and listing everywhere that it's streaming.
Nice. Okay.
Excellent.
Yeah. Let's make sure we put up where we found these.
Yeah. So, the ones that I did, are ones that I felt like were underwatched or ones that I thought deserved a little bit more love. And so, this one I talked about on the show last year when somebody let me know about it, but I thought it would be a good time to dust it back off. And this is Hell House LLC. Which is streaming on Amazon Prime. And this one is a found footage film, which usually I don't like. But last year, while I was at Phoenix Fan Fusion, everybody kept telling me that I had to see this movie. And I ended up watching it. And it's just a really, really well done found footage film about a group of kids who buy a haunted house with the intention of opening up as like an amusement thing. Like they're going to turn it into a fake haunted house and open it up and creepy stuff starts happening. The film was made on a shoestring. I would be surprised if they spent more than like $25,000 on the entire thing. But it's just really cleverly paced. The scares work really well. Like it clearly had some skill. I have not seen, after the success of the first one, they ended up making a couple of sequels, which I have not seen. I've heard mixed reviews of the sequels. But the first one definitely packs a nice little punch and did not get a lot of love on its initial release. So I highly recommend checking it out.
Awesome.
Nice.
Right.
Yeah, it's good. It's definitely worth the time.
I got one that ties in a little bit to what Lee was talking about, which is that kind of the Burbs perfect society and feeling alienated. It's on from the Criterion. It's probably on Amazon, but I did see it on the Criterion channel, which I only just recently got finally. And it's Targets. And this movie I saw about 20 years ago, and it didn't really stick with me at the time. But this movie, watching it again, it's a total flat out masterpiece. Like this is one of those movies that people should be teaching. It's especially right now with all the shootings in schools. But it's it's Peter Bogdanovich making his first film for Roger Corman, and the instruction was he had to put 20 minutes of what's the movie poster in Blumhouse The Terror. Yeah, The Terror. Oh. That's right, in the conference room we would normally be sitting in. And so that was his restriction, and usually people just do this in a very shitty way. They just, you know, kind of cut around it. But he took it and decided to make Boris Karloff, and he had a couple days left on Boris Karloff's contract, and he basically decided to make a film about an aging movie star whose last film was The Terror, and has decided not to make any more movies. He's been invited to do kind of a retrospect at a drive-in. That's one of the stories. So you get Boris Karloff at the end of his career playing one of the only really straight roles he got in that last, you know, 30 years of his career. And it's very satirical about what he actually went through. And then the A story is just, it's so well done. It looks like it's almost set in a Tim Burton, Edward Scissorhand type suburbia of perfection. And it's this all-American, clean-cut, blonde boy with good parents and a loving wife. And he is just going through something and you're not sure what it is. And he buys all these guns and all this ammo. And at a certain point, he basically starts to break, and he starts by shooting his mother and wife in a scene that actually shocked me. And I don't remember the last time I was shocked in a movie like this, where I was just sitting there. I was like, oh, Jesus, like the way he did it, it was just so matter of fact. And then he basically picks a tower, a spot in L.A. to start just shooting people on the freeway, and eventually ends up at the movie theater, making a little hole in the drive-in screen and taking the audience on as a target. So his storyline is basically on a crash collision course with Karloff's. And it just has an unbelievable, where it goes in the like last 15 minutes is so smart, self-referential, and honestly seems smarter about the gun problem than anything I've seen since. And this is a guy's first film, and it was seen as a throwaway, you know, for Corman at the time. It's really holds up in terms of performance and just little details about it. So I
remember hearing about this movie on the podcast, You Must Remember This.
Oh yeah. That makes sense.
Podcast, but, is it two questions? What year was it made?
It probably would have been maybe 68 or something like that. I didn't write it down, but it would be around that period because it's
great. So, where is it available to watch?
I saw it on the Criterion Collection, but I know that it's also on Amazon Prime. It's pretty common. Like, oh, it's 1960. Yeah, it is 1968. Just looked up. I think I avoided seeing it again because I thought it was going to be kind of an exploitation film on that topic, like most of Corman's work, and it's one of only two or three not exploitation type movies. It's actually quite serious, but also really entertaining. Karloff's great in it. I think for the moment we're in, forget the virus stuff. All the other stuff we were going through before that we've forgotten about since the virus. As a society, I think it says something without preaching.
Oh, great. Cool.
Yeah.
Targets. I still haven't seen that one. Okay, so that was that. My pick is a film from 1992. It is available on Amazon Prime, and it is called Split Second.
Oh, nice.
I saw that not long ago.
That's a good one.
Kim Cattrall, Rutger Hauer, really cool creature that feels like it's stylistically designed and inspired by Judge Death from the Judge Dredd comics, except if you just poured black tar over his entire body. But it's directed by Tony Malam, who also did one of my favorite slashers, actually. This goes back to my favorite slashers conversation, The Burning.
Love The Burning.
Yeah, The Burning is amazing. But this is basically set a little bit into the future. Flooding has taken over our cities, so it's constantly raining. And basically, Rucker Hauer plays a cop who is up against a serial killer that may or may not have something to do with black magic and Satan and all kinds of dark, you know, kind of mystical things. And then what he discovers is that the serial killer is not human at all. And Kim Cattrall is one of its targets. And it's pretty cool. It's a cool, weird, definitively early 90s creature feature with Rucker Hauer making Rucker Hauer choices. I remember seeing it when it first hit VHS, and I did not particularly care for it, but I really liked the monster. But over the years, I've been incredibly kind to it, and I revisited it recently on Amazon Prime, and it's just one of those kind of guilty pleasure flicks.
Nice.
Nice.
Lee, what do you got?
Okay. Well, what else? So I can recommend Ringu, the Japanese version of Ring. Now, obviously, a lot of people have seen The Ring, the Hollywood remake of this film, and a lot of horror fans have seen the original Japanese film, but it had actually been a while since I'd seen it. I think the last time I saw Ringu was in theaters at the Melbourne Film Festival, and so it just was re-released. It's on iTunes at the moment, and just watching it again, it just the stark power of it and how terrifying it is. It really is. It's one of those movies that just absolutely holds up in terms of scares to this day. And, you know, obviously had a huge hand in kicking off the J-horror craze. But I would encourage anybody, obviously anyone who hasn't seen it, to watch it, but even people who haven't seen it in a while, to go back and revisit it. It's just a masterpiece.
Yeah, Arrow had sent me over a Blu-ray, and it's sitting at the top of the pile, and I want to revisit it. And it's, you know, one of those movies that remember seeing at the height of the J-horror craze, loving it, seeing Gore Verbinski's film, loving that. And something, you know, it's one of those movies very much like, I don't know, like Texas Chainsaw and Black Christmas. It's not a movie I just want to keep revisiting because I don't want the power diminished. So I'm very excited to kind of get back into it and see it with fresh eyes, like over a decade later.
I'm a fan of the American remake, The Ring. I like that film, and I think it's a well-made film. It's a very strong film, but there's something very polished and almost safe about it. There's a safe in that Hollywood slickness. And the thing that the Japanese film has going for it is that it's a step removed from that. There's something a bit unknowable about the Japanese version, something a little more, I mean, obviously to us in the US and in Australia, it's quote-unquote a foreign film with subtitles. But beyond that, there's a little bit of grime on the movie that isn't there, that Hollywood slickness isn't there. And I feel like it's that extra little bit more unnerving because of that.
You said you saw it back at the Melbourne Fest, but did that one have any influence on what you guys were doing, you know, early on in some of these movies? Because some of the build-ups, not obviously Saw, but more like Insidious, because I feel like some of the scares kind of remind me of that kind of build-up somehow.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I actually saw this film with James Wan at the Melbourne Film Festival. And we went together. We used to, every year, you know, prior to streaming services offering every movie under the sun, we would go to the Melbourne Film Festival with the guide in hand, and they would release this guide, and we would go through every movie, and we would tick off all the horror movies and go and see them obsessively. And this experience just changed us. Like, we walked out of the theater, I remember, just dumbstruck, and we kept talking about it, and it really did have a big influence. It was right before I wrote the first draft of Saw, and I think it had not only as an inspiration in terms of, like, you know, we've got to make something that really grabs people by the throat,
right?
You know, but in terms of realizing exactly what it takes to scare people, like, The as you guys know, as hardcore horror fans, the amount of truly scary films, it's a slim amount of movies. There might be movies that we love for different reasons. Maybe they have great effects. Maybe we think they're funny, or maybe they have a nostalgic place in our heart. But for the amount of movies that are truly, truly scary is pretty slim. And I think Ringo's one of them. It's one of those movies where you want to live up to that power. You want to be as scary as that film was. And I remember the theater's reaction when she crawls out of the TV.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, people lost their minds, and I felt like that was something that wasn't captured in the American remake. That moment, that moment in the Japanese film will just knock your head off.
Yeah, and I know, and yeah, I think it's, you know, it would be interesting, and I'm sure if some film student out there did a compare and contrast of Verbinski's coverage and
I've
rhythm.
I've had
of
students
that.
Write that paper.
Yeah, between that and what Nakata did, you know, because I just remember it was like, it just felt like you know, Marcus Nispel's Texas Chainsaw to Hooper's Chainsaw. It goes back to that slickness.
It's a slick, and I found it disappointing in the American version. They intercut that moment with a car chase, basically, with Naomi Watts like screeching down the street, and it really detracted, I think, from the power of this moment. In the Japanese version, is in that moment is so pure. It's just purely horrific, and it's just a masterclass for anyone who wants to get into writing horror films or directing horror films, because it doesn't cut any corners, and it does something that vibrates on a different level that really gets under your skin, which is really hard. You know, it's relatively easy to make someone jolt in their seat if you have a loud enough musical sting, or if you have. But to unnerve somebody, that is very abstract. How do you do that?
Yeah. And
Ringu is a masterclass in unnerving people. I mean, I can tell you this. I watched it at night and I had difficulty watching it. It was I ran up the stairs when it was up.
That's great. Yeah, I'll have to put that on my list for this week. I've been meaning to rewatch it. Becca, so that was Ringu. Which you can find on where? How did you watch it, Lee? On iTunes. Okay. And Becca, what are you? What's your second pick?
So my second pick is Lisa and the Devil, which is currently screaming on Someone Can Drink Now, Fandor, because you can drink whenever I say it. Lisa and the Devil, I had never seen this before. I thought I had, but had not. This is Mario Bava, and this is from 1974. And the whole setup of it is that this American woman goes on vacation to this tiny little town, sees this crazy kind of fresco large painting that depicts the devil. And then all of a sudden she starts seeing this guy who looks just like the devil all around town, and shit starts getting really weird. People around her start dying. There's necrophilia. She starts having all of these really weird dreams. The devil character is played by Telly Savalas, like flawlessly. It's beautiful. And so, yeah, it's really bizarre. This one is truly like a fevered dream. It's really disjointed. It's really trippy. A lot of times you don't know if she's really seeing these things or if it is dream sequences, and it really goes places. It gets weird. There is supposedly, there's an exorcism scene in it that was supposedly tagged in at the last minute because The Exorcist had just come out, was huge. And so Lamberto Bava went back and shot this exorcist scene and kind of added it in. So yeah, that's in there as well. But it's basically like Spanish aristocrats and the devil and all of these crazy cults versus this American tourist housewife.
Wow. There's another title of this one,
I think, called Exorcismo or something. It's got another exorcism type title, a ripoff title, I remember.
Yeah. I'm looking right now. House of the Exorcism.
Yeah. It's a good movie, though, that Lisa Nedova, and Telly Savalas is really good in it.
Yeah, he's really good in it. But yeah, it's a fun little film. Really beautiful because they are using this tour. It's this kind of like really tiny town and this tour group. So a lot of it is kind of looking at the town itself. And yeah, it's just absolutely gorgeous. And I think it's supposed to be somewhere in America where they are. I think it's supposed to be like Toledo or something like that. But they're clearly someplace in like this tiny little European village where everything feels very old. Wherever they are, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, I remember aspects of seeing like trailers of it, but I've never seen it. Where did you find this on the?
This is streaming on Fandor right now, which you can add through Amazon Prime for like a couple bucks. Oh yeah, it's on Fandor. Now y'all getting really drunk.
Yeah. Hey Elric, what's your number two?
Okay, I got a fun one that you might actually dig if you haven't seen this one. So there's a movie that my friend Dick had on Blu-ray called The Chosen. And 2 weeks in a row when we're watching movies, I pulled it out and he said, we'll do it one day. And then this weekend, for the other show I do, we did an episode with Tarantino. And of course, in the middle of the episode, he just goes, and there's this great movie called The Chosen. So I was like, well, fuck, now I've got to watch The Chosen. And the reason he brought up is because it's we were talking about ripoff movies, and this is one for you, Ryan. This is a ripoff of The Omen, made a year later, and it is beat for beat The Omen, but it stars Kirk Douglas, and it's a big movie. It's not like a little movie. Right. It feels like a major studio film. It also had the title Holocaust 2000, which you can see why that's not a great title. Italian director Alberto Di Martino, he made a couple, this thing called Blood Link, which I've always wanted to see, but this is just so close. Basically, Kirk Douglas is going to start a nuclear power plant in the middle of this holy land. And of course, you know, a lot of people are protesting him. His son's name, I kid you not, his son's name is Angel. And guess what? Oh, he's the Antichrist. Oh, I mean, and he's blonde. He's a perfect angel, but he's like a 20-year-old. He's not a kid in this one. So it's almost like jumping in where like part three of The Omen would go or something. But it's interesting, and it's got some parts that just, you know, it's not a great movie by any means, but it's a really interesting one because it feels so big. And so basically, Kirk Douglas is going through all this, but then in the middle of his film, he starts having these nightmares, and the nightmares are like ripoffs of Exorcist 2, the flashbacks in Exorcist 2. So now it's like ripping off The Omen, and then it's ripping off Exorcist 2 with these crazy dreams of Kirk Douglas buck naked, like schlong and all. You actually see everything. It's just him running through a desert. Yeah, and this is like, you know, Kirk Douglas around the Fury time. So, you know, aging Kirk Douglas, but you know, he looks good naked. He's running around the desert and all these surreal fucking things are happening, and he's slowly coming to terms with the fact that his son might be the devil and that this big project he's been working on might lead to the end of the world, and he's going to have to decide whether he will take in the signs or not. But it's I was pretty impressed by it. I probably wouldn't have pushed the button had it not come from that source, but you know, these movies, especially when it's something so close to a movie you love like The Omen, it's pretty interesting to see beat for beat. And when it has a gore scene, it's kind of slow moving, quite talky, but when it does have a gore scene, it goes all the way. Right. Like a guy's head just, you know, the top of someone's head will come off and be super gory. So I think it will satisfy that part. But when you look it up, I think it's under The Chosen, not the other one. I think Scream Factory put it on Blue, but it is on Amazon. That's what I watched it last night. Okay. I dug it. I thought it was for you. You're the one I was thinking of by the end of it. I was like, I think you'll like this one.
All right. I'll have to check this one out. I just looked up The Chosen and I got something about Jesus.
Different film. This one's 77. There's a 1981 religious film called The Chosen. Don't watch that one.
All right, got it. All right, my number two is a Shudder pick. I have not seen Demons 2 in quite a while.
Love that movie so much.
Demons 2 is fascinating and fun and not on par as the experience as Demons 1, but close enough for me, because we were talking about sequels earlier. It's kind of like a mix of, well, what did you love about the first one? What's the feeling of the first Demons? How can we inject it into the second one? How can we expand on it? And what I completely forgot about Demons 2, because I saw Demons 1 recently at the New Bev, is at the very end, you know, it's fucking full on like demon apocalypse. Like there's like people on trucks and shooting, you know, ammo into these demons. And, you know, you got this family driving off into the night of the Jeep and you're like, what the fuck happened? Going into Demons 2, I was like, okay, the world is okay. We're focusing on Coralina Cataldi as she's having a birthday party. I was like, what happened with the events of Demons 1? What happened? I thought we were living in a demon apocalypse. And, it seems that part of the city got walled off and it's about these people that go in over the wall into this kind of like ghost town area of where the demons broke out. And I was like, that is fucking cool. Like, I love that the world has accepted that there was this demon outbreak and then they walled off the part of the city or the world or whatever where it happened. And there's always this potential that it can flare back up like a virus. And sure enough, it does, because these people broke into the walled off city. And then through some weird demon logic, because it's being broadcast, Coraline is watching the broadcast version of whatever this, like, kind of people going into the city. And then through demon logic, the demon comes through the TV. And then a possession happens, and then the demon outbreak happens all over again. But it's contained, not to a theater this time, but to an apartment complex. And so you get to meet all of these people, like a baby-faced Aja Argento, who's probably like 12. You've got a couple of character actors who are in the first Demons that are playing different characters, a la, you know, Return of the Living Dead, Return of the Living Dead 2. But it's a blast. I mean, like, the movie's a lot of fun, disrupts the rules a little bit, but endlessly fun. I'm a big fan.
So I've mentioned on the show before that this movie fucked my shit up when I was a kid, because this came out. I was probably 8 or 9 years old when this came out. I may even have been younger. And I begged my mom to let me rent it. I remember seeing it in like the new release section. And I begged my mom to let me rent it. I had not seen Demons 1. I was just a kid. I just loved the cover. And she let me rent it. And I took it home and I watched it on my parents' couch. And the moment that the demon comes out of the television, it like melted my fucking brain. Yeah. Like that, I just could not. I mean, and I had seen horror by this point. Like, my parents had let me watch like Return of the Living Dead, and I'd seen Fright Night. Like, I'd seen funny horror films. But yeah, the demon coming out of the television just melted my brain for a long time.
I looked it up, and then you were indeed 8 years old.
Okay, I was 8 years old.
Which is kind of amazing.
Thanks, Mom and Dad.
Year of horror movies where demonic characters come out of television.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good time. I miss those days. Lee, what's your third and final pick?
Well, it was really hard to narrow it down, of course, but so I decided to go for something that maybe a lot of people haven't seen, that a film that I really love by a filmmaker I really, really love, Karin Kusama's film The Invitation.
Yes,
oh, yeah. Is just a really unsettling, unnerving film, really bare bones. Obviously, a film that was made on a low budget, you know, utilizing one set and a small cast of actors. It's a real chamber piece, but for anyone who loves really like boiling kettle tension in movies, you're going to love this. It's quiet. It takes its time. I guess it shares some DNA with Swallow in that regard, that it's, yeah. But it's, I really found this film unsettling, and it has one of the more unnerving endings of any film I've seen in the last, you know, 10 years. It really got me, that ending. And of course I worked with Logan Marshall Green on Upgrade.
Yeah.
I love his work. And that was the movie where I first became aware of him in a real way. But, I don't know. Have you guys seen this film? Did it have the
same thing
on you as it did on me?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's such a pure return to form for Karin Kusama. I mean, like, Jennifer's Body is fantastic, but I think this is like a nice other side to her in terms of her directing abilities, but just her, you know, her directing aesthetic. It's just like Aeon Flux was more, feels like a bad studio experience, but Jennifer's Body, you know, injected a lot of what she had in there. And this was like a nice kind of return to form, going back to the basics, just dread and tension.
Oh my God. I mean, I remember I saw this in the theater in a movie screening at the Overlook Film Festival a few years back. And
that's where I saw it as well. I was in that same screening.
Oh, you're in the same screening. Great. Yeah. I was there with a little film called Cooties. Which
I saw there as well.
And it was this great horror film festival, and it was at the hotel that, according to legend, originally inspired The Shining. The whole festival took place in this hotel.
I was so sick for the first few days, so I had never been up that high in my life, and I had no idea that this would happen. But I got altitude sickness for the first 2 days I was there, where I couldn't stop vomiting, and I kept getting nosebleeds, and I kept thinking, like, I'm dying. Like, I came to this, and I am dying. I am going, like, full starry eyes here at this festival. And then after about 24 hours, it stopped, and somebody told me what was going on. And then I was fine for the rest of the festival, but for the first 24 hours I was there, I was a fucking wreck.
It's a crazy festival, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
It was a blast. I was part of a tricycle race, or I guess it was big wheels outside in the snow. I almost got attacked by a moose walking back from a bar one of the nights. It was a trip.
I remember you were there, Ryan, but I remember there was this sort of experimental game that you could opt into.
Yes. Yep.
And you could opt into one of two levels, either the sort of platonic, like, hey, we're playing a game, or you could opt in for the extreme version where people would break into your hotel room in the middle of the night and tie you up. And I kept hearing about these people whose hotel rooms were raided in the middle of the
night. That was ours. I mean, there was nothing like the experience of imbibing in a lot of beverages in one night. And Ciara and I had just started dating not too much sooner. And I just remember we both got seriously drunk, went back to our hotel room, and then at 3 a.m. had three cloaked strangers break into our room where I was only wearing my underwear and Ciara was in whatever she was wearing. And I was just like, freaking the fuck out, and they were just throwing chicken bones at me in the middle of the night.
I remember I did not take part in that. I'd actually planned to, and then the first day, the nosebleeds, I was kind of like, I just need to stop everything. But I remember looking out of my hotel room one night at like 2 a.m., and they had some type of bonfire going in the back, and they had all these people gathered around in this very cult-like manner, and were doing some type of ceremony back there.
We were raising some demons back there, Becca.
It was some crazy shit, man.
For any listeners who are thinking of going to the Overlook Film Festival whenever the world returns to normal.
It got postponed this year. I just got the email a couple days ago.
Yeah. Definitely a fun film festival for horror fans, but that was the first time I'd ever been to that festival. And I sat down. I had no idea what I was watching. I love watching movies that way. I never get to do it anymore, but I sat down. I was like, the invitation, huh? Okay. And just really kind of boiled me alive. The suspense in it was hard to deal with. Like, Karen did a great job just building dread in that movie.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. It's incredible.
Absolutely.
Becca, that was the invitation by Karen Kusama. Becca, yep. What do you got?
So I'm going to throw two really quick. So the first one is currently streaming on, I believe it's on Shudder. Yeah, it is on Shudder. And this is a really quiet British horror film that I just always thought did not get the love and attention that it deserved. And this is the 2011 film, The Awakening. And this is directed by Nick Murphy. It is set in a very kind of, I'll call it Victorian. It's not Victorian. It's 1921. And there is this woman who's an author, and she is a supernatural debunker. She's a supernatural hoax expert, and she is called upon to go into this boarding school to try to solve this haunting that they have. And it's all very public where she's being sent in there. The boys are all reporting this ghost, and she's being sent in there to kind of break it up and show everybody that it's fake. And she gets there and she can't do that. And I love this. It's just such a tight little scare. Feels almost kind of like this bucolic 1920s British sentiment, but there's got some amazing scares in this. Just absolutely amazing. Because a lot of it is kind of shaped in the minds of like school children at this all boys school. It's got a lot of tones of Woman in White as well. And so, yeah, when this came out in 2011, it fell off the face of the earth real quickly, possibly because it is this very kind of British horror in the 1920s. Like, it's a historical piece. Even the cover is this woman with her hair up in a tight little bun with a very kind of turn of the century style dress on. And the movie itself is really slow paced, but it's just got some beautifully woven scares in it. So I highly recommend checking it out. This is The Awakening. And it's currently on Shudder.
And the woman that you're talking about is one of my favorite. You're talking about Logan Marshall Green, but an actress I also love from this era is Rebecca Hall, who played Christine in Christine, which is a true horror story. Not the Carpenter film, but the one about the journalist who shoots herself live on air. And she's also going to be in Friends of Ours film coming out this year, the new Bruckner film, Night House.
Yeah,
she's the star of that. She's a terrific actress.
Yeah. And I just, this movie is just so tightly wound. She's phenomenal in it. It feels a lot like The Orphanage. It's got a lot of kind of the similar tones and setup because it is this vast kind of boarding school where they are trying to figure out this haunting and the history of it. But yeah, it's really cleverly done, beautifully shot.
Very.
And then the second one, which I will just give a quick shout to, because one of my students reminded me of it this morning because since all of my students have been trapped at home with everyone else, I've been opening all of my online classes up with, okay, what are you guys watching? What do I need to see? What's streaming that I need to catch up on? And so most of the week has been dominated by Tiger King, of course. But one of my students reminded me of the movie Circle, which is currently streaming on Netflix. And how topical this is. And we ended up really talking about it in a lot of class this morning. And I had not disregarded, I really enjoyed this movie, but I did not like the ending. And it made me not revisit it or give it a lot of thought afterwards. But now I feel like there's a lot of really important social statements being made in it. The whole setup of Circle, currently streaming on Netflix, it's a really small film. It is 50 people wake up standing in this completely kind of black void room. And they're standing on these spots. And they discover really quickly that if they step off of their spot, like head for the door, this giant metal device in the middle of the room electrocutes them and they die. And they quickly realize that they are controlling who it electrocutes. And they have to decide who out of the 50 of them to kill next until it's down to just a couple people. Like they are literally parsing it down, deciding which one person in the room deserves to live.
It's the best Saw sequel I've ever heard of.
Torturous, and it gets, and I absolutely loved the film up until the end when they reveal what's been going on because they have no idea what's going on the entire movie. It's, and they float all these different theories. It's very Cube-like in that regard where they're trying to figure out why they're there and what happens if we do this? Like, how can I cheat the system? But wait, I was just thinking about how badly this dude needed to die because he was pissing me off and now he's laying dead on the floor. And then they realize they're controlling it. And then it gets into kind of this who deserves to die, who deserves to be the best, who is the best member of society, what makes you better than me, kind of theme for bulk of the movie. And the last 5 minutes, they reveal like what the big twist is, what's going on, and then it lost me. But up to that point, there is something really cool, and it's got a really nice social statement and has a lot to say beside from that last 5 minutes, which some of my students completely dug, so what the fuck do I know? So, and that was on Netflix right now.
All right, Circle. Elric, what's your final pick?
My last one has no social statement and value will be questionable, but Ryan will be smiling because both of us have recommended this before. So I was teaching two and a half, three weeks ago, and I said goodbye to my students because they headed to spring break, and I've never seen them again. They all went away to spring break forever, and I picked a little movie called Welcome to Spring Break, a.k.a. Nightmare Beach.
Oh, yeah.
Bring in the big gun.
Love it.
1988, Umberto Lenzi pretending to be American. He directed Spasmo and some other great Italian movies. This is all set in Florida, the place that is still trying to kill us all. And anyway, it's spring break. You have all these students who basically are congregating for spring break. But the key story is it opens with this kind of, it's almost like Shocker or something, where you got this this criminal murderer is about to be of a biker kind of gang is about to be executed, and the whole movie is basically you thinking that his vengeful spirit has returned on this motorbike with a wraith-like bike helmet. And the cool thing about this film, when I first stumbled upon it, I was like, what the fuck is this movie? Because his bike basically doubles as an electric chair. So he'll grab somebody, put them on the back of the bike, and then electrocute them to death. And this is happening. So you have this very strange, serious, very dark horror element, and then this really goofy, you know, spring break, all these young, you know, college kids partying, and these two storylines somehow come together. You get John Saxon running around, you got Michael Parks drunk, pretending to be a minister, saying it's Claudio Simonetti from Goblin Score. It's like such a bizarre movie.
It's so good. It's Lee, this is definitely, you have to check this one out. It's so weird.
I'm writing all this down. What's the name of that film again?
So when I looked it up, the Blu-ray is Nightmare Beach, but on Amazon, it's under Welcome to Spring Break.
Welcome to spring break.
Yeah.
Well, guys, you can clearly see that there's a socio-political statement along with that. Okay, I got nothing. No,
there is now.
You had me. You had me at wraith-like, so I'm in.
But no, but I do like it because I'm thinking, like, literally, I'll get an email every week going, "Oh, we're extending spring break for another week. We're extending spring break, and now it's forever." So, it, to me, this is the perfect movie to watch right now.
Spring break forever.
Now you got me wanting to revisit it. I remember it was one of the first discs that I bought when I got a region free player, and I was and I just bought it blind. I mean, like, I was like, okay, it's a slasher and a bike helmet. I'm sold. Night school kind of vibes. Yeah, so yeah. I need to get into it. And it's so much fun.
Yeah.
All right. My final pick is a film that's kind of recent, the last at least 6 years, 6-7 years. It's the Dowdle Brothers, As Above, So Below. This one's on Netflix. I see people talking about it every once in a while, but in terms of the
As Above, So Below.
Yeah, it was a found footage movie. These are the guys who did Poughkeepsie Tapes,
which is currently streaming on Amazon.
Yeah, and it's a movie about, like, urban explorers who go beneath the streets of Paris into the catacombs where all the skulls are and all that stuff, the Parisian catacombs. And they basically go a little too deep, and they wind up kind of in hell. It's kind of like they start getting.
I don't think it's kinda. I think they literally, like, flip to hell.
Yeah, and so they start, like, you know, finding markings and runes, and ghostly shit starts to happen, and then time and space starts to get fucked up. And. And I remember, you know, I remember when it came out, I was still a journalist, and I remember really liking it, touting it then, and revisited it lately, and it still holds up. I mean, it's like one of the better found footage movies to come along. And it tried to, I mean, like, the Dowdle Brothers demonstrated that they had a good handle on the kind of found footage craft, the storytelling, and, you know, with studio money, they were like, let's show you what it's all about. And I think they did a very, very good job of it. They haven't done much horror since. They did kind of, I think they did like a Patrick Wilson survival story, I think. I could be completely wrong about that. And then they did a Waco, TV show that I haven't had a chance to check out. But the Dowdle Brothers were always guys I feel like were big horror fans and were giving us some interesting things. But As Above, So Below is now on Netflix. Give it a shot. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I remember this was when I was kind of done with found footage. Like, this was at the tail end of the found footage craze. It was kind of drifting to where... Yeah. People were getting a little fed up with it. And I remember being discouraged because of that, but it was doing such cool things. I still would have rather seen it as, like, a regular third person omniscient film. Mm. But it has such cool stuff going on. Then again, a lot of the scares are built around the fact that it is found
footage.
That's
the thing. Yeah. There was a lot of good stuff that was, The storytelling device was deeply connected to the kind of found footage aesthetic. So, you know, I kind of felt the same way back when I first saw it. I was like, oh, that should have just been a regular, you know, regular film. But then there were some gags that really worked. And yeah. I don't know.
I remember there's, like, the cultist down there. And then some of the things that, like, are moving, they're only scary, like most found footage, they're only scary that they are moving because we're catching glimpses of them in blurry camera. And so, yeah, I mean, the scares are built out of that. But that said, it was such a cool premise of this, like, exact opposite fucked up world existing beneath ours that I absolutely loved. And, you know, now that you mention it, I really want to rewatch Devil. I always liked that movie. I thought it was kind of smart.
Oh, Devil. Right.
Wait, not the one in the elevator?
Yeah, that is the one in the elevator.
I forgot about Devil. Shit.
Yeah, I kind of like that one.
That was interesting. Yeah, that was interesting. That was also Logan Marshall Green, I think.
Yep.
Yeah. Huh. Okay, well, those are our streaming picks. You know, sound off. Let us know what you thought of them if you choose to check them out. Lee? Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me and letting me rab it on about horror movies.
No, that was great. That was great.
Can I ask Lee one movie recommendation question quickly? I love that, like, we haven't really talked about Invisible Man, but I saw it with Beck, and we both love the film. But I want to know, do you have, like, a 90s thriller, you know, psychological thriller? Because I love how it opens, where the very opening of your film feels like you've, you know, Sleeping with the Enemy or a movie like that. But, you know, of those kinds of movies, do you have one you particularly like?
Of the 90s thriller genre?
I call them the 90s yuppie thrillers, but yeah.
Yeah, so we're talking about movies here like Pacific Heights, Single yep. White Female, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle.
Oh, yeah.
You are well-versed.
Okay, I do have one. One that really stuck with me when I saw it, and it does hold up, is Bad Influence.
Oh yeah.
It's Rob Lowe. In one of his, I think one of his better acting jobs, he plays this real creep, and James Spader, who usually plays the yuppie creep, is the victim in the movie. And it's actually written by David Koepp, I believe,
yeah.
Who wanted to do Jurassic Park. But that's a movie, where did I watch it? I believe it's on Amazon Prime. It's definitely available on one of the streaming services.
I know.
It's one of those 90s thrillers that may be more underseen than, say, something like Hand That Rocks the Cradle or Single White Female.
When I was doing the Lifetime movie last year, I watched a ton of those movies just to kind of get myself into the thriller vein. And I watched it on Vudu. I'm not sure if it's still there, but I remember going to Vudu and seeing Bad Influence there. Yeah, it's fun.
It would be good with them.
Kind of noirish too.
Oh, it's very noirish, yeah. It would be good with Mulholland Drive. It's kind of like the relationship those two women have, or kind of like this weird symbiotic relationship that Rob Lowe and Spader have in that film. I like that one a lot.
Yeah, for sure. I think I saw it when I was too young to really understand. Like, it really messed with me.
Yeah.
You know, this movie, you don't quite have a grasp of sexual politics or world politics yet and society. And so it really it messed with me, and it doesn't quite – some of those scenes don't hold up as much as you want them to, but I can definitely I wouldn't say that's my favorite, but maybe that's my most underrated 90s thriller. If you're making me pick one, I mean, you got to go back to Fatal Attraction. I still feel like that is still a real classic in that regard.
Adrian Lynn's a really good director. That's the thing. When you watch his movies, even though they sometimes become jokes, you go back to them, and he really knew how to put a film together as a director. But the thing about your film, the reason I brought it up is the one thing I remember leaving that going that was so interesting is the lack of not having to see the domestic abuse. And I remember saying to someone afterwards, it's because we've seen those movies that you don't need to see that. In your film, mm-hmm. It's like we have a shorthand because we've watched 100 movies with all about that. And at the start of your movie, it's like I'm remembering that. And so I can imagine what it is, the control he has over her.
Yeah, I felt like I just felt like I wanted to drop the audience right into it. And I felt like it would really hamper the film to have a 5-minute introductory scene where he's like, you know, you call this jacket iron? You know, it's just not, I can never make Adrian as scary as the audience can make him in their minds.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To me, it was like the first scene of Jaws. You know, if you had seen the shark, I think it would have kneecapped the entire mm-hmm. scene.
Yeah.
What sticks in our mind is the not seeing it. And I just felt it would be more powerful to just drop right in there. And Elizabeth Moss is such an amazing actor. She can communicate an entire backstory with a look.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, and you wouldn't see that kind of desperation that she shows, the behavior and timing everything out that she has worked out, unless it's real, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's a really great movie though, Lee. Congrats. I loved Upgrade. I thought that was as good as it gets. And so it's nice to see, you know, two in a row is brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know. I was just thinking today, I'm thinking about what I'm going to do next, and I'm like, I can't help it. You know, I'm like, I need to make a trilogy. like the next movie has to have some connection with Invisible Man and Upgrade, so that, you know, in years to come, if I'm lucky, people will look back and go, you know, that was his Control trilogy.
Uh-huh. I love it. All right, Lee. Well, thank you so much for joining. We'll let you get back to your family. Happy quarantine. Stay sane.
Guys, keep these recommendations coming. Even if I'm not on the show, I need you to be texting me regularly because if you know I'm going to run right over to watch Grotesque. I'm a big fan of 80s punksploitation.
Okay, it's right up there. Yep.
Have you seen Nomads? That's like a necessity.
I have. I mean, of course, there's like Class of 1984. And
Oh, yeah.
Like, it was right in that era when 80s movie producers didn't really know what punks were, but they knew that society feared them. So they would get them hilariously wrong. And I love it. And so it sounds like Grotesque adds a little bit to that little subgenre.
Definitely.
Thanks for coming on. We'll have to have you back to nerd out and get some more recommendations from you. So thanks again, man.
Fangoria and Blumhouse present Shockwaves. Shockwaves is a member of the Fangoria Podcast Network, hosted and produced by Rob Galuzzo, Elric Kane, Ryan Turek, and Rebecca McKendry. Sound recording, mixing, and editing by Ernie Hurtado. Music by Gregory S. Burkhart. Logo art and design by Aaron Crawford. For Fangoria, Dallas Sanier, Phil Nobile Jr., Jessica Safa-Vamare, Brandon Wynardi, Natasha Pacetta, and Rob Galuzzo.